The Motherhood Channel is your trusted source to provide in-depth information from UC San Diego experts focused on pregnancy, childbirth, and the first year of life. Visit uctv.tv/motherhood for more.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to switch now to talk about the clinical landscape here and opportunities for collaboration within the department. Let me start again with just reminding everybody of the divisions that we have here in our department. You can see MFM, our hospitalist division, midwifery, our nurse practitioners, 21 generalists. We have GYN oncology, REI, urogyn, and family planning. And we're top ranked in the US for the services that we provide. In terms of our training programs, this is an amazing area where we gain a lot of ideas from our trainees. They're so smart and they're able to bring forward some really good thoughts about what we need to do to improve the care that we provide. We have 24 residents and then three fellows from each of the different specialties. However, following the legacy of Dr. Robert Resnick, who established our fellowship 30 years ago in 1975, we are going to grow our fellowship to have two fellows per year for a total of six per year. And same thing with urogynecology. They're going to be increasing their fellow complement. We are very, very excited about that. But I also wanted to just talk about how UCSD care and also some of our research, our OB registry in specific, reflects the population that we care for here in San Diego County. So just to orient you to this figure, you can see in the light blue that we have the San Diego County population demographics. And then in the middle blue, you have the UCSD clinical care population demographics. And in the darker blue is the OB registry that we maintain here at UCSD. And you can see that it very much mirrors the demographics of the population that we serve clinically, which is very, very important and something we aim to achieve, to have our population that we care for be reflected in the research that we produce. And now, where are we located in San Diego? We are everywhere providing OB and also GYN care. And so I've placed stars throughout San Diego County to kind of show you the reach that we have. As you guys know, UCSD Jacobs Medical Center is where our labor and delivery is, and it's housed here in La Jolla. But we also have fetal imaging and outpatient clinics in that La Jolla area. We then have our maternal fetal care and genetics, which we'll be talking a little bit about, that houses our fetal imaging, genetics, and outpatient clinics. And then now in Hillcrest, we have our older hospital, but also we have the new McGrath fetal imaging, which will be opening up and will be housing our future fetal surgery program. We have very specialized OB clinical programs here at UCSD. We have our diabetes and pregnancy program that really cares for women with pregestational diabetes, and most of the women with pregestational diabetes in San Diego County, as well as gestational diabetes, and offer state-of-the-art care. We have our high-risk obstetrical clinics, which provide comprehensive maternal care for maternal complications in pregnancy, as well as fetal complications. And we also have a new postpartum care clinic that is starting, and an HIV medicine clinic that has long been standing. One of the things that I've failed to mention on here is a maternal mental health program, which offers maternal mental health support for our patients as well. With regards to obstetrical imaging here at UCSD, we really are cutting edge with regards to state-of-the-art fetal and placental imaging. We have our fetal and maternal care imaging center that cares for mothers as well as fetuses, obviously. And you can see here on the top right, this is one of our area of expertise, which is the placenta accreta program that we have here. And we are experts in diagnosing this, and we include collaborations with oncology as well as radiology for the care of our patients, which is a very complex condition to care for. But we also offer genetic services to be able to provide care for our mothers and fetuses with genetic abnormalities. We're hoping to open the fetal surgery program soon, later this year. And you can see on the right bottom hand is our partners, Dr. Amarua and Nan Chang, performing a fetal transfusion. And so hoping to be able to not only provide the service clinically for our county, instead of having our patients travel long distances for these services, but also for our trainees, and also a wealth of potential research collaborations that can be done through the center. I also wanted to just discuss some of the patient care conferences that are very collaborative here at UCSD. We have the Placenta Accreta Spectrum Conference. Again, it's attended by radiology, maternal fetal medicine, critical care, anesthesia, ICU services, our nursing staff. We have the cardio obstetrics population conference, which again, we welcome the collaboration from our cardiac specialists and also all of our colleagues that are necessary to provide the best care possible for our patients. We now have our rheumatologic conference, and starting this year, we'll be also adding inflammatory bowel disease conference. So as you can see, with regards to our clinical services, we provide a very collaborative environment to provide the best maternal care that we can. But we also have top-notch imaging for the patients who come into our center, and we're able to help them, and hopefully in the future with our fetal therapy center, help those fetuses to thrive. So we are well poised with regards to our clinical programs to not only collaborate clinically, but also with regards to your research. And we welcome your questions and your research ideas with regards to maternal health, placental health, and fetal health. And with that in mind, I'd like to introduce Dr. Louise Laurent, who will be talking a little bit about her work on the placenta.
Great. Thanks very much. In my role as also one of the co-directors of CORI, welcome to everyone. So glad to see everyone here. I'm going to talk a little bit about, not CORI here, but a collaborative project that my lab has undertaken. So this project, I'll talk at the end, I'll show all the collaborators, but include people in radiology, including Rebecca Reichel-Penner, who's in the audience today, people in pathology, as well as people in other institutions, including the Jackson Labs and Duke. And this is part of the Human Biomolecular Atlas program funded by the NIH that covers all sorts of different organ systems. We are the only group that looks at female reproduction. And I'll just talk a little bit about the placenta. We do study a few of the other organs in pregnancy, the fallopian tube, ovary, and the uterus, but I'll just focus on placenta today. Okay, so quick introduction to the placenta. This is a cross-section of the placenta. The placenta is basically a disc. This is a cross-section. This is the umbilical cord. This is the fetal surface. I'll talk about it as either the fetal surface or the chorionic plate, potentially, if I slip into jargon, sorry. Maternal surface over here, or the basal plate. Down here, this is what we call the decidua, the endometrial layer of the uterus, and this is the muscle layer, the myometrium of the uterus. The structure that I will really focus a lot upon is the villus. The chorionic villus is this branching structure. We refer to it as the functional tissue unit of the placenta. It's like where all the action happens pretty much in the placenta. And so we're going to really zoom in on this as we go along. Okay, so here, this is just a little zoomed in on the villus. You'll see there are many different cell types. I'm going to talk a lot about the cytotrophoblasts, these yellow cells, which are proliferative, and they give rise to two other cell types, the syncytiotrophoblast, which is in green, or STB. These are the cells that transport both nutrition, waste, oxygen, fluid between the mom and the baby, and it also is the site of most of the hormone production of the placenta. And then here, these ectrophilous trophoblast cells, EVT in red, they anchor the placenta to the maternal tissues, and they actually invade into the maternal tissues. They even replace some of the cells lining these maternal vessels here in pregnancy. So why do we want to study the placenta? Because we want to figure out, what is the difference between placentas in different biological conditions. And today I'm just going to focus on some really high level, obvious ones because we need to start somewhere. So before we run and look at disease, we want to walk and just study normal placenta. And so I'll talk about two main conditions. One is labor and not labor of the term placenta. And then I'll also talk about the placenta through gestation, through the course of development, through the pregnancy. And I'm going to refer to this table a bunch of times. And these are just types of questions we can ask. For example, what are overall differences, for example, between labor and not labor in the placenta? What types of cells are in the placenta? if you see a difference between labor and not labor, which cell types are changing? Or is it just that the different cell types are changing, not in what their behavior is, but in the number of cells? So these are sorts of questions that, you know, we in the placental biology think about all the time. The new technology is allowing us to not only see what types of cells are there, but who they're next to, what their neighborhoods are, and how they talk to each other, which I'm referring to as cell-cell signaling. So these are just large areas of questions. And I'll talk about the different technologies that we've used really quickly and what types of questions they can answer. So this is like old stuff now. When I was going to grad school, this was like not even on the horizon, but now this is every day. This is called bulk RNA-seq. You take a chunk of tissue, you ask what RNAs are in there. You can do this for placentas from vaginal deliveries and C-section deliveries, and then each of these dots is a gene. If it's in this gray, it doesn't really change much between vaginal delivery and C-section. If it's red, it's higher in labored placentas. In blue, they're higher in the C-section placentas. You can look at other questions too, like male and female babies. There are differences. There's like all these differences here. This is the Y chromosome. These are all the genes in the Y chromosome, not surprisingly. But as you can see, you get this cloud, you get lists of genes, you can do some functional enrichment analysis for people who know like pathways analysis, but it's still very big picture, right? So basically you can look at global differences, you cover the whole transcriptome, you can look at every RNA that's there, you can look at all the cells that are there, and it's pretty cheap, so you can do hundreds to thousands of samples, but you don't know which cell types are there, and you don't know what each cell type is doing. And plus, if you have really rare cell types, they get lost in the noise, right, of all of the different transcripts running around in your chunk of tissue. So you can answer basically two categories of questions using bulk RNA sequencing. All right, so you can then do single cell or single nucleus sequencing, and this is just one of the data sets that we generated as part of this project. And in this case, each dot is a different cell. And the relationship spatially in this picture is just which cells have more similar RNA sequences and what we call ATAC-seq or chromatin accessibility signatures. And here you can annotate the different cell types. So, you know, syncytiotrophoblasts, which I mentioned before, extravillous trophoblasts, those invasive cells, these tiny, you know, yellow cluster here, CTB, the proliferative progenitor cells, the cytotrophoblasts are over here. So, so you can get data on lots and lots of cells. This is 43,000 cells just about, in all these different types. You can do some comparisons between different conditions, and I'll have to say that we just got data right off the presses on some different conditions, but I didn't get, the supercomputer did not work fast enough for me to share them with you. But this is just showing you that you can look at lots of cells at a time and get really detailed information about them. The advantages are single cell or single nucleus resolution, data from thousands of nuclei per sample, you cover the whole transcriptome or the whole genome, but you have no spatial information. You've blown apart your chunk now into all the individual cells, and you get data on each of the cells, but you don't know who they were next to, so you don't know who they were talking to. Also, super expensive, so you can only do usually dozens of samples at a time. So these are the types of questions that you can answer with what we call the multi-omic or single nucleus, single cell sequencing technologies. Okay, so this is the first of our spatial technologies. This is data that we generated using the GeoMx machine that's actually here, was here in this building, just moved to another home for sort of logistical reasons. But basically, you can take a section of tissue. So this is as if you had a pathology specimen, you cut it, and then what you do is you can pick out different areas and you can do sequencing on those areas. And in fact, you can do better than that. If you have markers for the certain cells that you care about, you can actually profile just those cells. So for example, we use PAN-CK, pancytokeratin, as a marker of the syncytiotrophoblast, and CD31 as a marker of the endothelial cells. You see these beautiful syncytiotrophoblast layers here, and then these beautiful fetal capillaries. You can profile them separately. So you can say, what do the red cells do in this picture? What do the green cells do in this picture? And you can come up with lists of these different things. Now, going back to the bulk RNA-seq, I showed you this picture. I'm going to highlight. There was this gene, aquaporin-3, which is higher in labor than in bulk. Labor than C-section placentas. But we didn't know which cell types they came from. Well, with GeoMx, we could say that they are higher in labor in the syncytiotrophoblast specifically. They're not in the endothelial cells. They're not in the stromal cells in the placenta or the extravillous trophoblast. Specifically, non-labor, it's not on. In labor, it turns on. So you can really look at individual genes, who's making them, you know, in that whole tissue. Another thing you can do is you can look at the same type of cell in different locations of the tissue. So if you look at a double staining between cytokeratin and HLA-G, you get the extravillous trophoblast. They are in the basal plate, so in this area. They're also in the septa of the placenta. And they're also in two other areas of the placenta. They're at the chorionic plate, which is where the fetal side is, and they're in these other structures called trophoblast islands. So with GeoMx, you can pick these areas separately. And what you see actually is that if you compare the differences and similarities between those extravillous trophoblasts in these four different locations, they break out into two different groups. The chorionic plate, or the fetal side, and the islets, there's only six genes that are different between them, so they're very similar. And then between the basal plate, or the maternal side, and the septa, they're also quite similar. So you basically have two main populations, and you can actually identify markers that separate these populations from each other, which is actually, I think, super cool. All right, so in GeoMx, spatial information is preserved. You don't have cell type bias in your capture. It's also whole transcriptome. The problems are that it's not single cell. You need at least 20 cells of a given type to actually profile it. And as you might see, it takes quite a bit of technical expertise and a good eye to pick out which areas you want to look at and what markers you're going to use. So just highlighting again, there are, you know, other questions you can start answering, including spatial relationships with the GeoMx. I'm going to move on to another spatial technology. This is called imaging mass cytometry. So unlike the GeoMx, this is imaging. You see everything that's there, right? Cells, not cells, everything. Here, the limitation is you have to pick which proteins you want to look at in this. It's an antibody-based assay. Here, we pick 28 proteins custom, develop the assays for them. And here, I'm just showing DNA for the nuclei of the cells and four markers for looking at the cells within them. So this is, of course, very pretty. I love these images. But what can you learn? Well, you have to then go into a very complicated and and sophisticated set of bioinformatic tools that help you, quote, segment the cells. So this is a beautiful picture, but where are the cells? How do you recognize cells? So we have a collaborator at Duke, John Hickey, who developed this segmentation tool called Mesmer, which helps identify the cells, and then it clusters them according to the similarity in their expression of those 28 proteins. And this is just another way of looking at it, where now we have the cells across the cell clusters across this way, and each of the 28 proteins this way. So a big dot means that a lot of cells in the cluster express that protein. A dark dot means that they express that protein highly. So you have both color and shape telling you about abundance of the cells in those clusters expressing that protein, and darkness, how high that level is. And basically, to me, this is the kind of figure to look at about 20,000 feet, because you just want to look for patterns, right? So you might want to say, well, you know, what's going on here? This type of cell is expressing basically this one protein. Well, these are B cells, right? If you look over here, this cell here, this type of cell is expressing basically only one thing very highly. It's tryptase. These are mast cells. So these are very rare cells in the placenta that normally you wouldn't see unless you had nice markers for them. You can also start seeing, we have syncytial trophoblast, but we have four different types of them. There's endothelial cells, and there's five different types of those. So these are the things you can start learning if you have an imaging type of technique. So for IMC, there's spatial information preserved. There's no cell type bias. It's actually very sensitive because antibodies are very sensitive. It can detect some very rare cell types if the right markers are chosen. The problem is that only a few dozen proteins can be detected. If you don't choose them correctly, you can completely miss a cell type, right? If you have a marker for a cell type that you don't pick, you're not going to see it. is also very slow and expensive, and so you can't analyze that many samples. We did four sections of term placenta. It took us a month to generate that data. So I know Ina's here, and she has the next generation of that machine, which is much, much faster. We actually ended up, quote, breaking the machine at the Jackson Labs, and they retired it right after our project. They had to change the detector on the mass spec attached to that machine four times during our project. So, but it did generate beautiful pictures, right? So so you can look at new cell types if you pick your markers correctly. You can see differences in cell numbers because there's no bias, and you can look at spatial relationships. So IMC is great for what it does. This is our newest platform that we've brought on. This is called Xenium. So this is an imaging system, very similar in an idea to the imaging mass spec, except that it primarily looks at RNAs. So you can pick your favorite panel of about 300 to 500 RNAs. We did 300 because that was the state of the technology when we started collecting our data. We went through the literature as well as our multi-omic data and our genomics data and picked out 300 genes that you see here to mark the different anticipated cell types. So this is actually from our prior data. And so I'll focus here basically on trophoblast across gestation. So on each of these pictures, the coloring is the same. Syncytial trophoblast, that transport layer, is in blue. Cytotrophoblast, that proliferative layer, is in yellow. These light blue are actually syncytial trophoblast on the way to being, cytotrophoblast on the way to being syncytial trophoblast, and then EVT, the red ones, are the invasive cells. So you can see in the first trimester this beautiful pattern of these are the villi. There's a continuous layer of the proliferative cells that then feed into the outer layer. And then you can start seeing here the STB cells just under or at the bottom here. And then you can start seeing the extravillous trophoblasts that are quite abundant in the first trimester. When you go to the second trimester, the EVT are much less abundant. You can also see that the proliferative progenitor cells are much less abundant. And in the third trimester, it's almost all syncytial trophoblast, right? So this is the evolution, the maturation of that organ, the placenta, through gestation, reflecting, you know, what its role is at each stage of development. And you can actually take these and you can quantify the different types of cells. And so you can see that transition I just described in words in this graph where the STB layer becomes more abundant and the other layers drop off over gestation. And so you can then do a dot plot like this and look at these different cell types across gestation, first, second, third trimester, and the fact that actually there are different markers for these cells. So it's not just the abundance of each cell type, but the cells are changing through development. And then finally, I just wanted to show this, this case because it's so beautiful. This is a first trimester gestational sac, basically in its entirety. So the sac is in the middle, and then the placenta that's developing is all around it at this stage of development. And what you can see is if you dive deeper, you can see this inset is similar to the previous set of slides. It's coming from this area. And what you can start seeing is there's multiple types of progenitor STBs, and there's multiple types of the extravillous trophoblast as well. And you can see that they are spatially changing. So there's one level here proximal to the gestational sac, and then other types of EVT that are more abundant later, farther out. And again, you can start looking at what are the differences in the expression of different RNAs in these different subpopulations. So Xenium, we're super excited about. Spatial information is preserved. Again, no bias in the types of cells you look at. A plus and a minus, it can see more transcripts than, for example, the IMC can see for proteins, but it's still limited. It's not very sensitive, so the number of genes it can detect per cell is a little smaller than all the other technologies, and again, it's very expensive. So again, things that you can see. One thing I wanted to talk about is right now what we're doing in the group is integrating all these different data to try to get a fuller picture. And so, you know, by combining all of these technologies, you can capitalize on their strengths, get over their weaknesses, and then integrate that to map the data so that you can ask all of the questions. All right. So I just wanted, last slide, thanking all the folks involved, several people in OBGYN, including Katie Fish and Marnie Jacobs and Scott, Lindsay Hewitt, Valentina Kayla. I saw them all in the audience. Folks at Jack's over here in the lower right, and then and their leader, Paul Robeson, Mona Parast in pathology, and then John Hickey at Duke. So thanks very much.
I feel like that was a nice segue, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you all about the Mom Health Study and the MODE Consortium. And I'm actually going to flip this a little bit, even though the title says Mom Health Study and the Multiomics for Health and Disease Consortium or the MODE Consortium. I'm going to talk about the MODE Consortium first and then how the Mom Health Study fits into it. And just want to mention I have no financial disclosures related to this talk. So the MODE Consortium was actually conceived by the NIH as a collaborative initiative to advance the application of multi-omic technologies to study health and disease in communities that have not traditionally been included in genomic studies. The goals of the MODE Consortium overall are to explore the use of multi-omics integrated with phenotypic and exposure data to detect and assess molecular profiles associated with healthy and disease states. Second, to develop generalizable data harmonization, integration, and analysis methods, as well as best practices and standards for the optimal application of multi-omics, and to create a multi-dimensional data set that is available for research to the research community. And in order to accomplish this, the NIH sought disease study sites, or DSSs, to propose studies focused on disease areas for which integrative multi-omics could be used to define associations with healthy and disease states and detect changes in associations and molecular profiles over time. And so they gave some guidelines for these disease study sites. Basically, they were looking for diseases that could be studied with 200 cases and 100 controls that would include phenotypic and environmental exposure measures, and that would do measures and collect samples at least 3 time points. And just with this solicitation, they actually found awarded 6 disease study sites that are very varied. They span from diabetes and kidney disease to liver disease, asthma, and maternal health, specifically preeclampsia and hypertensive disorders of pregnancies, and also include 2 pediatric sites, so both pediatric and adult cohorts. And prior to the study even starting, there was a defined 1-year planning period. So this was to bring together all disease study sites, the Data Analysis and Coordinating Center, or the DAC, the Omics Production Center, or the OPC, NIH, an external advisory board, and a community advisory board to standardize activities across the consortium. So this included defining common data elements, or CDEs, that were going to be collected by all sites, including demographics, medical history, clinical measures, social determinants of health, and lifestyle characteristics, sample collection protocols for both blood and urine, as well as nasal swab and stool, and standardized data production at the DAC and the OPC, which includes omics and metals. And the goal of this harmonization is really to make sure that the data sets that are generated for use are comprehensive and are combinable across all disease study sites. Yeah, so in consortium-wide enrollment actually just began in February, which we were very excited about. And you can see here, I hope from this map, that these disease study sites, omics production centers, and the DAC span across the United States, so very varied. And not surprisingly, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to focus on this site right here, which is right here at the University of California, San Diego. But this is actually in conjunction with Vanderbilt University, so I do want to highlight that this is a dual site study. Which brings us to the Multi-Omics for Maternal Health, or the Mom Health Study. And our study focuses on preeclampsia and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. And I know a lot of people in this audience are aware, but for those who aren't, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy comprise both chronic hypertension, which is hypertension that exists before the 20th week of gestation, gestational hypertension, which is new onset hypertension that develops after the 20th week of gestation, and preeclampsia, which is hypertension with evidence of some sort of organ dysfunction, and so it's a severe form of a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. And importantly, these are pretty common complications of pregnancy in the postpartum period. Here at UCSD, they affect about 25% of pregnancies, and including 11% of those with preeclampsia. And they're responsible for 14% of maternal deaths and about 10 to 25% of fetal or newborn deaths. And while we mostly think of these as being associated with perinatal complications, 70% of maternal deaths due to hypertensive disorders of pregnancy actually occur in the year after delivery. And this remains a really understudied component. And importantly, there are estimates that about two-thirds of these deaths are preventable with better detection and planning and monitoring. And they're also related to poor health outcomes later in life for both the mom and the offspring, and for the mom, including chronic hypertension, ischemic heart disease, heart failure, stroke, renal disease, and death. And so the goal of this mom health study is to uncover mechanisms that link preeclampsia and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy to postpartum maternal health outcomes, which have not been traditionally focused. This is a very big schematic, and I don't expect you to read all of this. I'm going to break it down for us. We're in kind of a unique position. So as I mentioned, the goal of the mom or the MODE consortium was to enroll 200 cases and 100 controls. But unlike the other diseases in the consortium, we don't know who's going to be a case and a control at the beginning. And so we have to over-enroll our population in order to ascertain our case control status. So we are trying to enroll 750 participants. This includes 200 high-risk pregnancies, which would be those with chronic hypertension, pregestational diabetes, renal disease, an autoimmune disease, or a history of preterm preeclampsia, and 550 low-risk pregnancies, which are basically pregnancies without these conditions. And after accounting for some small loss to follow-up, we expect that about 150 of our high-risk group will develop some sort of hypertensive disorder of pregnancy, 30 won't, and in our low-risk group, 50 will develop a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy, and the remaining 450 will not. And from here is where we're going to get our 200 cases and 100 controls. And we do plan to keep our non-hypertensive high-risk group in this follow-up as well, if we're able to. And while most of the disease study sites are looking at three time points, we actually cover the gamut of gestation and 1 year postpartum. The official enrollment for this study is 16 to 24 weeks gestation, but we try to enroll as early as 10 to 15 weeks. And at every time point, we're collecting survey metrics and samples. At delivery, we also collect placenta. And during postpartum, we're also going to be looking at the medical record to see what sort of health outcomes occurred in our participants. And along with this, we are also giving patients or participants at-home blood pressure monitors so they can take their blood pressure during gestation and postpartum. And again, as I mentioned, our hypertensive outcome is at delivery. So this is the time point that we'll be able to ascertain case control status, and we'll have collect samples up until this point. I want to highlight this at-home blood pressure monitoring because part of the goal of this symposium today is to foster collaboration, and we've actually been able to use some of this to foster some collaboration already. So we've been working with our population health team here at UCSD, who is already doing at-home blood pressure monitoring for adults with cardiovascular disease, but had been looking to expand into the perinatal and postpartum space. And so our at-home blood pressure monitor is actually integrated directly with the electronic health record. Our population health team has access to this wonderful dashboard so they can follow up with these patients if they have an elevated blood pressure and report to us as well. We also partner with one of our Werher scholars, UK Amarua, who's doing a watch study. This would be during the first 6 weeks postpartum for continuous blood pressure monitoring in a small subset of patients and using our same surveys. So her surveys align with ours so we can hopefully again collaborate and align data after the conclusion of both of our studies. And a not so shameless plug for our study as well. If you happen to know anybody who's interested or might be interested, please reach out to us. We're always looking for participants. This is a huge lift even with two sites, and we're really excited to have people champion it for us. And I just want to thank everybody for, thank you for the reminder. Thanks for having me. And I want to highlight our wonderful study team, without whom this would not be possible. And our study contact is at the bottom down here. And so if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us. We're always happy to talk about the study more. So thank you.
So I'm going to introduce the Human Milk Institute here at UC San Diego. And believe it or not, it's the first and only institute dedicated to human milk in the world. Speaking about neglecting women's health, there is literally no speciality that focuses on the normal function of the mammary gland. When we talk about the mammary gland, we talk about breast cancer. But we're kind of neglecting that the mammary gland is there for a reason, right? And that is to nourish and feed the baby. So what is the Human Milk Institute? It is the central hub to advance human milk from molecular discoveries all the way to local and global public health impact. We started the Institute back in 2022. Our first symposium was in 2023, so I feel with you. You know, it's very exciting to have the first symposium. We are in our third and soon fourth year already. HMI is the umbrella structure for several different entities that are dedicated to human milk here at UC San Diego. That goes all the way from Center of Research Excellence on the left, MommyCore, through Mommy's Milk that Gretchen will be talking about, which is a biorepository around human milk. Emprint is where Jeremiah is involved. We're talking about maternal and pediatric therapeutics. So what happens to these therapeutics when mom is breastfeeding? We have a milk bank that uses donated milk and then provides that to preterm infants mostly. We have a SPIN program that supports preterm infant nutrition. And we have in the extended studies a lactation and perinatal education program. So you see, it really goes from research all the way to clinic, all the way to education. And since its inception, we added these different programs here. One is a human milk analytics core that really helps us validate methods to analyze what is in human milk, which is still highly understudied. We have a rapid response team that is started after COVID or with COVID, where UC San Diego was the research team that informed the WHO that breastfeeding is indeed safe when you are COVID or SARS-CoV-2 positive. We do a lot of work in the community. We work with industry partners, and we're building an education track around human milk and lactation as well. What's our vision? Everything is circled around human milk. I'm gonna make this really fast because I only have 3 minutes. You see all the different entities that I mentioned earlier, and I spaced them here where we are with health sciences on the left and health on the right. Extended studies up here for the lactation consultants, our external stakeholders, the government, corporate entities, not-for-profits, the community. We are building this milk analytics core, and we're trying to make that sustainable. We have an administrative backbone. We're trying to make that sustainable. We're working with the Prepare Institute, and we are hoping to build this rapid response unit and make it sustainable, because you never know when the next pandemic is hitting. We're having a community collaborative, and we're hoping to make that sustainable. We're having clinical working groups, hoping to make those sustainable. And we have something that is already sustainable, which is actually a chair in human milk research that I'm holding currently. And that chair has been giving out seed grants over the last 8 years to activate other people on campus to do research on human milk and lactation. So people that haven't really worked on this before are now brought in and expand the focus and the activities here on campus. So that has been very successful, and we're trying to mimic this now and scale it to bring on additional endowed chairs that focus on the mammary gland, on mammary gland biology. So you see biological sciences pop up. Milk composition, the pediatric outcomes of human milk, systems biology, engineering. All this is, of course, human interactions. So we're trying to bring in social sciences. And all this has a relevance when it comes to public health. So we're trying to bring in public health here as well. So really trying to build this multidisciplinary ecosystem for collective impact. Anyway, so we're trying to use this ecosystem here to build an education track called lactology, which doesn't exist in the world, and then have those different chairs teach lactology and really have a graduate program develops the new generation, or the first generation, really, of lactologists. And yes, we do have a symposium as well, and we have been able to make this sustainable. We got a $1 million endowment that helps us put this symposium together now every year. Here's a paper that started this. This paper came out the week before the pandemic was called, and it called to a better understanding of what we call the mother-milk-infant triad. And it says specifically that there are huge opportunities to improve maternal infant health. It's not just about the baby. Breastfeeding is also beneficial to the breastfeeding women. And we know that women who breastfeed are at a lower risk for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, all those different things. So we're trying to understand why that is. What's happening in the breastfeeding period that benefits mom just as well as the baby? So someone has said that before, multiple times maybe, we strongly believe that women's health is actually public health. And I leave you with that. If you'd like to learn more about the Human Milk Institute, please visit our website, send me an email, or join us for our next symposium, which is already scheduled for March 10 to 12 at the beautiful seaside venue down in La Jolla. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the invitation to speak today. I'm Gretchen Bandley. I'm an associate professor in pediatrics in the Division of Environmental Sciences and Health. So what I want to do is just share four of kind of the main programs we have in our division. We're a small but mighty division. This is us, Ken Jones, Tina Chambers, Miguel Del Campo, myself, and Carrie Bertrand. So the four programs that I want to talk about that are certainly open to collaboration. We've had a lot of collaboration through many different divisions, departments, schools over the time, and continue to welcome more. So to start with, the Center for Better Beginnings is kind of the mainstay of our division, run by Tina Chambers. And this is a program that enrolls pregnancy cohort studies, primarily studying medication and vaccine safety during pregnancy. We enroll in the first part of pregnancy and collect very detailed information about exposures, prescription, over-the-counter, nutraceuticals, kind of the gamut of exposures that people have over gestation, updated throughout the course of pregnancy, and then we follow the infant for a minimum of a year, collecting growth and neurodevelopmental outcomes. That has been expanded into Mommy's Milk, which Lars just mentioned. And so in addition to studying medication and vaccine and other exposures during pregnancy, it is probably equally, if not more important, because we know less about them in lactation. And so this is a cohort. Both of these are continuous ongoing cohorts. But here we're enrolling people during lactation. They give a milk sample, sometimes cereal milk samples. Exposure information is collected. The milk is banked for any sort of assay. And we continue to follow the child for variable durations for neurodevelopmental and growth outcomes as well. The other two things I want to highlight is we have the SOMI study. I work not primarily, but a lot in this space. It's a complete collection of births and fetal deaths in the state of California, created mother-child dyads. So we've linked the mom's hospital discharge records in the year before birth to the infant as well as her own in the year postpartum. This now represents about 7 million births in this data from 2005 through about a year ago. And we link this to all sorts of other databases. So we've linked it to DDS. We can now look at maternal exposures during pregnancy and outcomes like autism, CP, things like that in DDS data. We also have linked to things like Medi-Cal to pull in medication exposures. And then any geolocated database we can pull on to look at other exposures. And then finally, this study that we have running here, I'm the site PI for the Healthy Brain and Child Development Study. I have a few of my colleagues in the audience as well. And this study is a nationwide consortium enrolling 7,500 mother-child pairs across the U.S. Over the next couple of years, we'll then follow the offspring through the first 10 years of life with deep collection of neuroimaging, EEG, neurobehavioral, neurodevelopmental assessments. But we also follow the mom along as well, which sometimes gets forgotten in other child development studies. And so the ability to study that maternal child dyad over time. These data will be publicly released with the first release, hopefully in about a month. We'll go through the data use agreement that I'll put in. So anyone who wants to use these data and then when they come out in a few months, please let me know. All right, with that, thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ina Stelzer. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology. And I would like to talk about what we do in the lab, where we study reproductive and systems immunology. So the maternal immune system needs to adapt to pregnancy to establish and maintain tolerance to the semi-allogeneic fetus, which expresses genes and thus antigens that are coming from the father. We know that this immune adaptation is disturbed in pregnancy complications, for example, preterm birth. In my previous research and currently ongoing research, we have leveraged these immune dynamics to predict the onset of labor from maternal metabolome, immunome, and proteome in maternal blood samples that were collected in the last 100 days before the onset of labor. And since then, we have expanded these measurements to now only to now also look at the immunopathology preceding spontaneous preterm birth, and we have found that immune dysregulations of this maternal immune adaptations already occur in the first trimester in women who will later experience spontaneous preterm birth, which gives us indication that we might be able to find early biomarkers and potentially therapeutic targets to intervene eventually. So we, in our lab, the current focus of our studies is the brain-body connection in pregnancy. So the question is how the central nervous system or the maternal brain influences the necessary local and peripheral immune local and systemic immune adaptations in the periphery to allow for the healthy growth of the baby, and then also how the pregnancy influences the maternal brain. And we see the immune cell as the integrating hub of all these different adaptations, and these immune cells communicate across a variety of peripheral and central niches. These immune cells integrate the immunotolerogenic adaptation, the neuroendocrine adaptation that is driven in big parts by the placenta, then neurobiological adaptations, and also behavioral adaptations, for example, sleep or differences in feeding behavior. And these adaptations are all influenced by social determinants of health. So as a first indication of this neuroimmune synapse in pregnancy, I just brought some pilot data that we have generated in the lab where we've seen that treating mice with an SSRI, an antidepressant, decreases serotonin transport, synthesis, and downstream signaling in circulating CD4 T cells, specifically in pregnancy, which gives us an indication of how dynamic and modulated this communication between brain and peripheral system seems to be. We use we study this neuroimmune synapse using healthy and pathological pregnancies, and then also mouse models to investigate the mechanisms of the associations that we find during pregnancy, and then use computational models to integrate the data that we derive. The major technology that we're using in the lab is mass cytometry, or CyTOF, that you might have heard of, which allows us to generate single-cell functional immune profiles using antibodies of more than 40 or using panels of more than 40 antibodies, and then using imaging mass cytometry, which Louise already has introduced before, to generate spatial proteomic atlases, and for example, of the placenta. And we're doing this with our own CyTOF machine in the lab, which is open to all collaborators. So this is the latest generation, which is much faster than Louise, the previous. generation. And so we've also excitingly just started to integrate xenium measurements, so transcriptomics, with IMC measurements, which will allow us to integrate spatial transcriptomics and proteomics on the same slide. And then for the mechanisms or the mouse models that I mentioned, we're using chemogenetics for targeted neuromodulation, which allows us to causally link brain activity and neuronal circuits to peripheral outcomes of pregnancy and maternal immune adaptations. And so we're located on main campus in the CMM West building, and I hope to discuss more where all of your interests lies in maybe integrating the maternal immune adaptation to pregnancy in your studies. So thank you.